All right, so how about we change gears a little bit, and if there's any introduction to this, I'll leave the bookmark out there. Maybe there's an introduction, otherwise
yeah,
if you just want to...
Yeah, there is, because it describes something that that's people don't understand about poetry and about the cruelty of the poet. And the cruelty is a result of being objective in a situation that is emotionally upsetting. One anecdote is that there's a lady poet here whose father was a veterinarian. And she said, what's the process in poetry for you? And I says, well, say your father, the veterinarian, has his pet dog that he loves, and that pet dog gets hit by a car outside of your house. What does your dad do? What's his first responsibility? He loves the dog. Is he going to start weeping, or is he going to try to save the dog's life? I said, he's going to save the dog's life. So in other words, you suspend these overpowering emotions in order to save the thing that you're dealing with.
I'm reminded of a time in Little League where I was playing outfield and I stretched to get it and I didn't tear something,
yeah,
but it felt bad. And what I did was I made the catch, I stood up, I threw it in, and then I collapsed. Right?
Get the job done.
Get the ball into the infield and go on.
So I go to see my dad and he's dying. Although I'll just give you one more line, and this is how odd it is. I spent a couple of days with him, and he looked at me and he says, I'll be out of here in a few days. And I thought, out of the hospital, great. He's thinking positively. No, he was talking about being out of here. So I got home, and it's like being in this turmoil and watching my dad, I kept looking at things as if this poem has to be written. I don't give a shit what's going on. I've got to write this. Which means it now becomes an objective activity. It's more like an act of science than poetry. So that's for the memory of my dad. It can't be said, living, I can't imagine you dying. The window looked west, later a dust, a skiff, light, March snow, suburbs with an elevator, the lake, a bank of Indian land. You said they want a road. Want a road. Into these words, thoughts barely to notice the nurse, pleasant, caring, and human in the seeming cold millennial politic versus this kind of care. You dripping into a bag, bladder pain, pressure, TV up to your right, nonsense to waste what little time our small talk must contain. What can I say without cliche? I swear beneath my breath, angered by a finality undescribed. Ourselves, I think later, today, 2 weeks ahead in life after you died, not that death is exit from time, it is time. Not a veil, but a folding in space without wind, air, when the last instant is a burst as if the beginning of the world itself, now reversed and only of itself as fact in all its puzzlement. How to go on to form resolve and be of this body about to leave. And this is my father. I'm taking this razor back. The one I used to shave you, thinking I'm this close, though once we hugged in a parking lot, later a gravesite, and you winced at my move to intimacy, therefore distance and my fear as they warned of all unresolved. In a complex you taught, root hog or die. What can we do but imagine that our life be described in whatever instant of thought becomes image as the picture of me, the baby in your arms, you sitting on the root cellar door with time ahead, this time that I now inhabit to cancel my days, no image in truth, no subject but time that contains our demise, so that my attempt at the invitation to place a letter in your grave, I found instead a botched copper horse bulged in a desert scape that I tooled in an early grade. You had it, copper to last forever. I tacked it to my wall, your empty grave. Grieving, grieving, the resolve of the unresolved. And only this outside guess at your thought, the conscious measure of each shallow breath, pressures, anxieties, indignities, embarrassments, faults, hope, you said, I'm in my second childhood. I'm nowhere, an unknown somewhere, where my attempts for location, a wordless elocution, a lament in silence to let image, solid and only of the world, enter the eye to take my heart from this, left bereft and fatherless. That now I must, in the face of it, see a bit of a joke in our practical concerns, check my mutual funds. Legacy almost wordless, that day you, on the river in the rain, at the point where I thought, this is miserable, you said, it's all right with me. So I take the rain, my future, without you. You said, thanks for coming. I said goodbye twice without looking. The phone to you rang, you died. And I came into this world again, a strange and conscious birth, without word, without road, without a father. It's hard to read. But that kind of poetry gets, is getting missed, you know, that it's driven from, yeah, death and just the difficulty of, you know, dealing with a dying father that you're, you know, sort of close to, but not without difficulty. So this is a point where there's a resolution to it of sorts, I guess.
You alluded to something in there that reminded me of something that I think you said in an essay, that the poet's subject is time.
Yeah. I don't know how I come up with these things, because I don't consider myself smart.
But there is something incredibly perceptive in your work.
Yeah.
You'll be reading it, and then these just incredibly universal truths just pop up in such an original way that it's the mark of mastery, really.
It's odd that you say that. I was with Cecil Giscombe up in the desert less than a year ago, and Cecil's a wonderful writer, an American writer, and a lot of my connections are more with the States now and larger places, so I find that interesting. But we're driving along, and Cecil said something to the effect, it just kind of popped out. He says, what do you fear? And I said, drumming.
Bad drumming?
No, just drumming, because I wanted to be a jazz drummer since I was, well, I can play, but I didn't, you know, pursue it all the way.
Spang, spang-a-lang.
Yeah.
You know that, the cymbal riff?
Oh, yeah. But that
characterization of the cymbal riff?
Yeah, I do it every day.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get that down. But, so he says, what are you afraid of? I say, drumming. He says, why? And I said, I don't think I'm good enough. He says, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. But what happens with poetry, and I think there's, you have to have an incredible humility in the face of what you're given to write, obviously, and be the cruel objectivist in another sense. But there's always that sense, and the poem tells you that you're not good enough for this. And it redeems you because of that fact. So when we look at some of the contemporary writers who are ego-bound and ego-driven and career-driven and driven this and driven that, to me that becomes sort of, what a bright boy am I, you know? Well, stick your finger in the pie.
Your character is your fate, right? You laugh about that.
So, you know, it's like Creeley said too, I use him so often, but he once said, you know, again, giving a metaphor for how poetry works, he said, if your house is on fire, you're not going to put that into iambic pentameter. You're going to go out screaming, my house is on fire. You know, there's a Creeley poem there. So it's kind of the nervous breakdown in that breaks down any pretense of ego, it seems to me. And so, you know, there was a lady once said, at a reading, she said, do you write traumatic monologues? I said, exactly. The trauma is the source. So just, in other words, I've had a lot of fun with writing and thinking about how it works, and I do every day. But I think it's that ability to, obviously, I think there was a Martin Amis book, I'm not a great fan of his, but the book is called Against Cliché as Such. So with this kind of writing, as soon as you lapse into cliché, you're dead. So whatever originality comes has to come because your house is on fire. Or as Creeley also once said, I write short poems because my wife keeps coming into the room. These are not profound metaphysical aesthetic arguments.
But they're real.
They're real.
Yeah. And that's something that Al said. There was a recent Bukowski quote that started making its way around Facebook, at least around my friends. Yeah, and it was like, if you find yourself in the company of an old poet, he's either a master or a madman.
Exactly. Either way, with a drink in his hand, probably.